Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast, where I go in-depth with the most intriguing people in the world of soccer. In this episode, I'm joined by two guests. JP Delacamera of Fox Sports talks about his role as the lead play-by-play broadcaster for this summer's Women's World Cup. And Ben McCreel of OptiPro talks about the latest in soccer data analytics. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. Onward! Joining us now is JP Delacamera, the legend himself, who it has just been announced will be on the lead broadcast team for Fox Sports, which also employs me, full disclosure, during the Women's World Cup this summer. JP, thanks for joining me.
Grant, always a pleasure. I'm looking forward to France. We still have several games to go before we hit the Women's World Cup, but I think it's going to be another exciting tournament.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, too. We are recording this on March 4th, so this is before the U.S. plays against Brazil in the She Believes Cup. You've already called the first two games, both ties for the U.S. against England and Japan, but I'll also want to talk about the Women's World Cup itself and your preparations for that. And I'm curious, you've been on the podcast before, including during major tournaments like the Men's World Cup last year. How do you prepare between now and June for the start of a World Cup?
Well, I don't get too heavy, Grant, in the names yet. You know, obviously names and numbers because they don't announce rosters until we get closer. But, you know, teams in this tournament, for example, I've got some good notes now on both England and Japan. And after the Brazil game, I'll also have some good notes. I don't think rosters are going to change, you know, a whole lot from the 23 that you're seeing, let's say, with Brazil. You know, I got to think that at this point, coaches know at least 18 of those players. I have to think that way. You know, and the same with England. There are players that are coming back from injuries that people are concerned about. So there's always going to be spots like that. But I think the prep becomes a bit, I don't want to say easier, but maybe less challenging when you can see these teams in person. I think videotape will tell you a lot, and Fox is always great at providing us with other matches that we can't get to in person. But the best for me is the eye test. And when I get to see England up front, you know, and talk to Phil Neville. We talked to the Brazil coach today. We've talked to the Japan coach, you know, with a translator. I think that that all helps us with our prep for the Women's World Cup.
Now, what was your first Women's World Cup to broadcast? Was it 95?
It was 1995. And if we go back in time, all we did, and ESPN covered the games, I think it was Grand Slam Sports. The names, the companies have changed over the years, but I think it was Grand Slam Sports at the time. Hired me and Amy Allman to be the voices for that. And all we did was the U.S. games. There were no other games that we did. And at the end of the tournament, they thought the U.S. was going to get to the final. So as we got closer to the end and we see that the U.S. loses in that game to Norway, there was a big meeting, and what do we do next? Like, are we going to do the final, or are we going to do the U.S. game? And the decision was made to do the U.S. game. So in that Women's World Cup, this is how far we've come. That Women's World Cup, we did whatever it was at the time. I think it was six games and all U.S. games, and we did not do the final. And now on Fox, we're doing every single game, all 52 games. They're all live. 22 of them are on Big Fox. So it's really come a long way since 1995, and even before that in 1991.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, when you look at the Women's World Cup and how it's changed over time, are there any other little details from that 1995 Women's World Cup in Sweden that stick out to you now as being that's definitely in the past?
Yeah, I do remember when I was there thinking that we as a country will do a much better job in 99. I felt like it was a big secret in Sweden. The country was great, people were great, but stadiums were not. I remember what I would consider maybe high school or small college stadiums that we were doing most of these games. And I want to say, Grant, I think it was Helsingborg, maybe. I think it was Helsingborg. There was one stadium that I remember was a very good stadium because it housed a professional team. But I found that nobody in the country seemed to know. You know, there weren't signs in the city. It seemed like to me it was a big secret. I do remember that from Sweden. I also remember that it never got dark, right, when we were there in the summer. And so I think I put a pillow over my head partially so that I could make the room a little bit darker. You know, you'd be walking at 11 o'clock at night and you'd swear it was maybe 7 because it really wasn't dark. So those are the things that I can remember about Sweden, and all of that was different when it came to 1999.
And it's pretty incredible. It is now 2019, JP. 20 years have passed since that 1999 Women's World Cup that changed the culture beyond sports. And if you go back and look at highlights, full games from 99, that was your voice calling them.
Yeah, and that was before social media. If we had social media the way it is today back then, you know, imagine someone like Mia Hamm, if she was on Twitter, how many followers, you know, she would have had, right? Everybody would have been jumping on that bandwagon, and the same with the others. So it has come a long way from 99, but that was certainly a huge moment, not just for women's soccer, women's sports, but also all of soccer in this country.
Well, I was actually talking earlier today with someone about the 1999 Women's World Cup tournament, and because it's a part of history now, I almost sort of take it for granted that it happened. But somebody asked me what I was feeling like during that tournament, covering it and watching it go from not having a lot of anticipation to over a three-week process becoming the biggest story in the United States of any kind. How did you experience that during the tournament, this tournament, the Women's World Cup, that you had covered 4 years earlier when it didn't really make much of a dent in the public consciousness, to becoming this juggernaut of a story?
Yeah, I knew it was going to be big, Grant. I'd be lying if I said I saw a sold-out Rose Bowl for the final, but I think once the tournament got going and you saw the momentum, and when they sold out at Giant Stadium and then got bigger crowds along the way, then you knew that if the U.S. got to that final, that it would be sold out. But it was a pretty steady rise in everything, whether it was ticket sales and merchandise to, if you remember this, appearances on the David Letterman show at that time. I mean, he adopted that team. Dan Rather, when he was doing CBS News, was talking about the women. We had celebrities at practice. So I think once it got started, and once we got maybe into a quarterfinal stage, I mean, you knew this was huge. And then at that point, you know, the sky was the limit. And when it first started, somebody said to me, what would be a success for you? And I remember telling them, I think the U.S. has to get to the final for it to be considered a success. Because I thought, you know, if they get to the final, crowds are going to follow them. But then when we got to the final, I sort of changed my tune and I said, now I think they have to win it. Because even though I would have still considered it a success, I don't know who else would have, or how would we look at it today? It's still a sellout crowd, right? It's still chess match at the Rose Bowl, but had China won that game instead of the U.S., you know, who knows what would have happened all those years after that.
Yeah, I obviously the coach of the U.S. women's team in 1999 was Tony DiCicco. You called the 2015 Women's World Cup games with Tony and Cat Whitehill for Fox, and tragically we lost Tony since the 2015 Women's World Cup to cancer. And is it something where will you be thinking about him during this tournament? I know I will.
I'm thinking about him right now, actually. And this is getting fairly close to the anniversary of his death. I always think of Tony, you know, ever since we lost him, he was I consider him a very good friend and someone that taught me a lot about the game. I didn't know how serious the sickness or illness was at that time. I don't think many of us, if any of us, you know, knew at that time. Mm-hmm. I probably did the last game with Tony at a freezing Red Bull Arena, where I found out later he was going to help us out on the sideline, but it was so cold and he was so uncomfortable that he was watching the game from the truck. And I think that's the last time that I saw Tony. But I do think about him often. I think about him when I'm ready to do a women's game, whether it's a friendly or, in this case, She Believes Cup tournament, and without a doubt for the Women's World Cup. I'll be thinking of him for sure. He was a great influence on me, and I think was a great help to me, and I will miss him. I do miss him.
Yeah, I will too.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, it just in some ways, you know, he was a very good broadcaster, but he also taught me a lot just at dinners and other moments on the road, sharing his experiences and his knowledge.
Grant, you know what's great about Tony? If you and he were having a conversation, right, and you said to him something about a player, like if you said, I really think so-and-so is the best midfielder on the U.S. team, he would never pull rank on you and say, you know, you're crazy. You know, I've won the World Cup. You're wrong. It's this one. He would respect your opinion, yeah. And he would just say simply, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I like this one. Yeah. And how many people, you know, in real life would be like that? He's already won a Women's World Cup, yet he will have a conversation with you, and he's a regular guy.
Yeah, yeah. You'll be working with Allie Wagner,
yep,
at this World Cup. She obviously has had a rising star over the last several years, doing commentary for Fox, both the women's game and the men's game. How have you built a chemistry together since you've been working together?
I think sometimes with chemistry, it's kind of funny. I think I've always had a good chemistry with whatever broadcaster I'm working with, and I always think that chemistry has started immediately. But chemistry is something that you not acquire, but it grows over time, right? So the chemistry should get better. But I think when Allie and I started, just like when I started with whoever my broadcast partner was, whether it was Tommy Smith or Shep Messing or Ty Keough, I'm just throwing names out. You know, first game, I always thought, wow, that's pretty good. But then it gets better. And then when you do tournaments with someone, you know, you're spending a lot more time together, whether it's more meetings, more coffees together, lunches, post-game, whatever that is, you know, you're always talking about the game. And you talk about things that are away from the field too, and you develop that rapport, if you will. I've known Tony Meola since Tony was, I think, 19, playing in World Cup qualifiers. But I really got to know Tony when I did the World Cup with him last summer in Russia, because I was there for, I think it was 40 days. And I would say I came pretty close to having three meals a day with Tony for 40 days. I mean, we were always together. We were always doing stuff, walking, talking, whatever that was, and doing the games. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it's great if you have a chemistry in the beginning, which Tony and I had, but then it develops over time. But that's where you really get to know your broadcast partners. When you're spending, you know, 40 days with them, you're at airports, you're at hotels, you're in restaurants, you're in meetings, you're at stadiums. You're with them as much as you are with your family, if not even more so. So that helps with the chemistry.
Yeah, it really does become a team environment in the TV realm. I've noticed that myself doing TV work as compared to sort of my written work over the years. But
you're part of a team, right? We're all part of a team. So
yeah,
if you're working a show with me, whether you're on the sideline or in the studio or wherever you are, you're part of that team, right? It's play-by-play, analyst, studio people, sideline, producer, director, everybody. It's all – that's our team.
Yeah. In 2015 for the Women's World Cup, you were part of a three-person booth calling the games. This summer, you'll be part of a two-person booth. How big of a difference is that from your perspective?
I'm one of the people that actually likes a three-person booth if you have some kind of diversity in that booth. I think it worked for us in 2015 because Tony had a coach's perspective, Kat had a player's perspective, and that was as a defender. I think that there's got to be something that's different about the two analysts. Maybe one is a forward, the other is a goalkeeper. You know, one's an attacker, one's a defender, one's a coach, one's an ex-player, whatever that is. And I think that we had that. I think to make a three-person booth work, play-by-play is the one that has to sacrifice. You're the orchestra leader. You have to take time away from yourself so that you can lead those two into some on-air chemistry between them and get some educational points about the game on the air. So I think that when you do a three-person booth, play-by-play does step back, and I enjoyed it. That was a great experience for me working with three in the booth. I have no problem whether it's three or two. I think that when it's a two-person booth, you're not really changing anything because that's the way most games are done. But the three-person booth, I would do that at any time as long as you have the right balance, the right blend of people. And I know we had that in 2015.
So here's a question I've got for you for the World Cup itself. People get sick often when they're working at a World Cup. You're not sleeping a heck of a lot. You're working pretty long hours. There's a lot of people transmitting stuff just by shaking hands. How do you not get sick during a World Cup?
You sound like you're talking about the IBC, right? Because that's everybody was working so close together and all those long hours and all that. So I understand that. I think I've been lucky. You have to say luck plays a part of it. I mean, you could be the best liver in the world, right? You could not drink, not smoke, exercise and still get food poisoning the night before a game, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you still have to have some luck. But I think, you know, I try to get proper rest. That was hard to do at times in Russia. Mm-hmm. Whatever you take, whether it's emergency or airborne, I'm not giving commercial plugs out here, but, you know, those are some of the things that I might take if I feel even the slightest sniffle. You know, mm-hmm. if we're outside in the cold like the other night, I'm layered, so it's a couple of shirts that I'm wearing. One's a thermal. It's a scarf. The other night we had hand warmers. We had toe warmers, but I didn't use those. So I just think you protect yourself as best you can. But I also think, you know, you do have to be lucky. And I think for some of the people at the IBC, unfortunately, you know, they're so close to one another. You're touching a lot of things. You're shaking hands with everyone on a daily basis. At least when we were with our own group in Russia, it was pretty much a group of four or five of us that were traveling together. So, and nobody really that I can remember of our group was sick. So we were lucky there.
Okay. Do you keep track? You've been doing this a long time. Do you keep track of how many games of all types you've broadcast over the years?
No, there's no way for me to do it either. It's thousands. It's not hundreds. It's thousands.
Yeah.
I've done, just with Tommy Smith, well, I would say well over 3,000 events, whether it's games or shows. And when you think about that, that's a long time. But in the glory days of ESPN International, Tommy and I were under contract to do 200 events minimum, and we did that for over 10 years. That's 2,000 right there. So even if I had calendars, Grant, which I do, I think my calendars go back to maybe 2000 maybe, but I don't have things marked in there where I would say, oh, I didn't do that game or that game got canceled. You know what I mean? So there's no way to look it back up. So there's no way for me to tell. It would easily be north of 5,000 events if I included hockey, but even with just soccer, I'm sure it's that. I mean, I've done a lot of indoor games, games off the monitor, games in different countries. So one time there was an announcer who celebrated whatever the number was. I think I want to say it was 3,000, something like that.
Yeah.
And he made a big deal of it. And I thought, wow, that is a big deal. And then I thought to myself, I have no idea how many games I've done. Like, how did he must have counted them like as he went. You know what I mean? Because even with the best researchers, that would be a full-time job, I think, for somebody to figure out. Because, like you said, I've been doing this. You'd have to go back to my indoor soccer days in 82. I mean, that would be a lot of games to try to count back. So I really have no idea, but it's definitely north of 5,000.
We have a lot of aspiring broadcasters who listen to this show. And I'd be curious to know what sort of advice you would give to them.
Wow. I tell them to always stay grounded. That's one. Always be respectful to those that you work with. Like I said before, you know, you're all part of a team. I would tell them to watch all their games back, critique themselves. I would tell them to watch other games of people that you respect, see what they do well, and see maybe what they don't do well. You don't want to copy someone, but take the good from this one, the good from this one, the good from this one. Look at the bad from this one, this one, this one, and you'll have your own style. But I will always tell them, try to network yourself. Nobody's going to hire you without a tape. So make sure you can get a good tape or DVD or whatever the format may happen to be, and strive to be consistent, because at the end, it's just like with an athlete, right? Any athlete can have a good year. What separates the good athlete from the great athlete? The consistency of the years, right? Somebody's had a 10-year career in the NBA, and every year they're averaging 25 points a game. That's a terrific player compared to somebody that played 2 years and then they're playing minor league basketball and you never hear from them again. Mm-hmm. So always work at the consistency. And one thing I've always told them too is when you watch a game back, if you've done a game, you might think you did a horrible job or a great job, but it's never as great as you thought it was. And it's never as bad as you thought it was. And don't let one game define you.
I wanted to ask you also about the Connecticut Fusion.
I'm so glad you asked. That's my team. That's my labor of love. Connecticut Fusion, United Women's Soccer. That was a team that Chet Messing and I started. We were going to be the owners of it, but as we were looking for a place to play, the DiTommaso family, who own and operate FSA, Farmington Sports Arena in Connecticut, offered to be the financial backer for this and have Shep and I run it, and that's what we did. Last year, for two guys that hadn't done this before, I thought if we could pat ourselves on the back, second place finish, 9-team Eastern Conference, got to the playoffs, and we're one game away from getting to a Final Four. So now we're putting more pressure on ourselves, Grant, because I told you about consistency.
Yeah.
So that's what we want now from our team. But it was and is a labor of love. I'm not getting anything out of it other than the satisfaction of doing this. And at the end of our season, when I thanked some of our players for, you know, their effort and their dedication, they thanked me for giving them that opportunity to play at that level. And to me, that was all I needed to hear.
How do you have time to do any of this stuff?
Our coach, Tom D'Agostino, just asked me that the other day. I make time. There's not a day that goes by without me thinking about the team. Some days I'm just sending emails to players. We have about 17 players that are signed right now. We're looking at open tryouts for collegiate players, and they can't train with us unless they're on a spring break or some college break. You learn about these rules as you do these things. Yeah. And then for post-college players, we're looking for a tryout as well. But I do find the time to do it. Once the season gets started, I don't have to spend as much time. I'm trying to put a roster in place for our coach. But you're also dealing with sponsors that are, I can assure you, not easy to find. And you're dealing with practice times, training times for certain groups, certain individuals. There's a lot more that goes into it than even I probably thought when I first started it. But there are some things we don't have to do in the second year that we had to do the first year. First year, we didn't even have a name, no name, no colors, no nothing, no players, no coach. So that had to come together rather quickly last year. This year, we already had maybe 7 or 8 returnees months ago. So probably a third of our roster was already set in, I want to say, November or December of this year, when in fact, a year ago, we didn't even have the franchise till after January.
Wow. Well, JP Della Camera, thank you, as always, for coming on the show. Good luck with the Women's World Cup this summer.
My pleasure. I will see you in France.
All right. I want to thank JP Della Camera for joining me. Next up is my interview on soccer analytics with Ben McCreel. Joining me now is Ben McCreel, who's an executive vice president of Perform and the head of OptiPro. He and I were on a soccer analytics panel recently at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston. Ben, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Grant. It's good to be here.
Yeah, lots to talk about here, but maybe the best way to start is for me just to ask, what do you do in your job?
Okay, so I run the professional division of Opta. So hopefully people know a little bit about Opta from broadcasts, from reading in the media. We're basically the guys who do soccer data. We do some other sports like rugby and cricket, but less interesting for the US audience. But certainly in soccer, we've been primarily a kind of media-focused company. And providing data and analytics to audiences through broadcasts. So if you see stats on an MLS broadcast, it's coming from us. But I run the professional division that focuses completely on supporting teams, leagues, federations on how they use data and analytics to support performance. So whether that's improving team performance, it could be to look at oppositions, or it could go into recruitment and scouting and how they use data and technology to support that. So I look after a team of about 80 people who are scattered 14 countries around the world. And we work with about 300 clubs and federations on kind of supporting their performance analytics.
So you're clearly a global company. There are a few specific things I want to ask about, one of them being U.S. soccer.
Yeah.
And what U.S. soccer is doing these days in the analytics field. And from what I've heard, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, we have a great relationship with the guys at U.S. soccer. And it started probably 3 or 4 years ago. When we started to develop this relationship, we'd been working with MLS and with the clubs for a number of years. It's actually one of our longest partnerships is with MLS. And so, you know, our footprint in North America had really started to grow, and the recognition was starting to be there as to what we could do to support, you know, soccer in the country. And so we started to build this relationship with US Soccer. And they have a really fascinating challenge and a way of going about it. You know, they have an enormous footprint in terms of youth soccer players all over this country. As far as I'm aware, it's still one of the highest participated sports in the country, particularly at youth level. But because of the size of the country, the unique challenges that that brings, they need to find a way of keeping track of players from all over the states. And so one of the ways they can do that is through data. And it's actually a very common thing that we have in Europe, where we say that, you know, data is one of the best ways to scout players across Europe, because it saves money from travel expenses.
Yeah.
So this is one of the things that US Soccer wanted to do. And so our partnership with them has grown. We cover nearly 2,000 games a year from under 15s all the way up to the senior national team. And that's on both the men's and women's side. And we're essentially tracking player performance from not just MLS academies, but also local academies, down to you know, park soccer in the farthest reaches of the country. And they are then tracking those players and looking to you know, look at development process and how those players are developing, mapping those against current national team players, you know, players who have come through that system. They're hoping that over, you know, the next 5 to 10 years, they're going to have such a large database of these players that they'll be able to keep track of them in a way that, you know, is incredibly difficult because of the size of the country. So we're very much involved in that partnership with them. We track all of that data, we collect it all for them and pass that back to them. And we support them with the analytics and the processes behind that. But, you know, the real expertise lies in Soccer House in Chicago. You know, the guys there are doing incredible things. And I have to say, probably one of the best centralized data processes of any federation that we work with anywhere in the world.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles. We win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
How is that data collected? Like, logistically?
Yeah, so we have 5 offices around the world. Mm-hmm. And it's all done manually, believe it or not. And anyone that wants to come and see it, we're more than happy to open the doors up. We have 3 people for every game. And actually, you know, not for the youth soccer, but for every other high-level soccer game, we cover it live. So mm-hmm. we do all of the data collection live, so it can go to broadcasters, so that it can go to the teams for in-play analysis. So we have 3 people for every game. They're watching a live feed of the game, and they're collecting that through using hotkeys on a keyboard and then clicking on a screen to tell you what happened and where it happened. And then we have a third, sort of one person for each team, and then a third person who's checking that data as it's going, and they can scroll back in the video and kind of realign things if it wasn't right. So that process is happening every weekend in those 5 offices, and we're collecting that level of data for about 45 domestic competitions around the world, all live, mm-hmm. And then all of the international games as well. And then that's piped back through either feeds and data feeds or through the products that we provide to those teams.
And when you're doing stuff for like US soccer youth ranks, it may not be live, but it's essentially the same process?
It's exactly the same process, yeah. So for whether it's an under 15 game in North Carolina somewhere, or it's MLS, you know, starting last weekend, you know, it's all exactly the same process.
And this was more the topic of the panel that we were on up in Boston, which is how analytics are being used with development, talent development, and younger players. Are there any sort of really important things that you've learned about that aspect of data and what can potentially be useful when you're dealing with a large number of youth players who may not be even fully grown?
Yeah, so obviously that's a huge challenge. You know, I think in any sport, projecting talent is incredibly difficult. And one of the things we found in soccer, and this applies to senior recruitment analysis, it applies to performance analysis, is you have to understand the style of the game that you're watching or that you're analyzing, or the league that you're analyzing. Because actually that has a huge effect on a player's performance. We see all the time, particularly in Europe, you know, players transferring from different leagues and competitions, and the impact that that has on their ability to adapt, because the game is different, the speed is different, the physicality is different. And so when we're looking at youth players, it's a very similar problem. But actually, it kind of gets worse, because most youth soccer, and I'm being a little bit general here, but I've watched a lot of it, it's very possession-based. Mm. They pass the ball a lot, and they don't get pressured a lot. Mm. There's a lot of mistakes, obviously, but they all want to play the beautiful game in the way it was intended. Now, as we very well know, that's not always the case. I worked with a manager once who I sat down with him, and he said, for the first time, I just joined the club, and I wanted to get under the skin of what his football philosophy was. And he sat me down and he said, we all want to play like Barcelona, but we can't. So we have to play with what we have. And yes, we want to evolve our football philosophy. We want to play the game, you know, as attractively as we can, because we are an entertainment industry at the end of the day. But I haven't got Messi and, you know, Busquets and players like that. So I have to play the way it fits. And I think that's one of our biggest challenges in youth development, is that when we're analyzing the data, it's such high volume of passes and such high volume of events for players that you sort of have to manipulate that and weight that to understand how efficient a player is. So one of the best pieces of analysis that I've seen on youth development is about efficiency of players. How quickly can they make decisions? How quickly can they move the ball? Are they taking 2, 3, 4, 5 touches and 3, 4, 5 seconds on the ball every time they get it? Or are they able to play, does the ball move through them quickly? Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the elements that we spend a lot of time on, is understanding the style of the soccer that we're watching, and then being able to manipulate the data to understand how that could project to future performance.
Now, one thing that came up that I thought was interesting last week was that the data that's being collected in different countries on youth players is not transferable country to country.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I mean, the first thing to say is that there is a level of, you know, protecting young players and actually just protecting young people. You know, we take the integrity of our data and the way that we store it and collect it incredibly seriously. And, you know, there's things like now in the UK, GDPR, where we have to be very careful about how we protect our data. And that's a really important thing for us. But also, you know, the federations and the leagues, they want to protect their young players. They, you know, the data is available to teams in their own country. And actually, even that's only a recent development. So when I first started in the industry, you know, 11 or 12 years ago, we only had the data for our team in our games. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the opposition's data, and we certainly didn't have data from the other games that were happening in youth leagues. Mm-hmm. So it's only been in recent years that that data has become more available. But again, only within the league that you play or in the country that you're in. And it's a smart move. You know, you know, there are certainly plenty now of British players who are being stolen by Germany. You know, the US has had plenty of players that have gone over to Germany. I imagine the Germans would be very interested in any youth data that we had on US soccer players, or similarly in the UK. So it is an interesting part of our industry, and how that data is protected. I think it, you know, I can understand why it happens, but actually we do have one case. So we work with the KNVB in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. You know, the Federation for Holland, and they actually opened their data up.
In what way?
so that you can access, if you are working for a team and you're using one of our solutions, you can access not the full performance data, but you can access biographical data and playing data on youth players in the Netherlands. And again, that was a smart move because they recognize that they are a selling country. They need their players to go play abroad. They need their talent to be taken elsewhere to continue their development. And that ultimately brings financial recognition back to the league and back to the teams in the league. So there's two sides to everything. Yeah. But it's an interesting dynamic.
Okay. Are there any particular countries that are more right now welcoming of data analysis in soccer than others that might be more resistant?
So countries that welcome the geeks. I don't think it would be, I think it'd be a very obvious statement to make, but it's true that certainly North America has been very welcoming to the analytics community in soccer. The UK, it took a long time. And actually, we're still fighting through that. I think one of the challenges we have in the UK is that, soccer is so ingrained in our culture. It is the number one sport by a good distance. But we're also, very ingrained in the way we do things. And so that's been a huge challenge to kind of ingratiate ourselves to coaches and really get them to understand why this is important. I think over here it's you have a head start because of your other sports, because of how that culture exists and the fact that data and technology is such a huge part of those other sports. And generally, people who are coming up through the development system will have played baseball at some point and will have played football at some point. So I think that certainly helps. But that's not to say there aren't challenges here as well with some of that culture. And sometimes it can go the other way. And it's interesting. Recently, we acquired a company that we'd worked with for a long time who called Scout 7, who had been in the industry for 20 years, providing a database and a platform to write your scouting reports on. So very much the core of the game, the old school way of scouting players, which to me is incredibly valuable. My background was across that as well. I've written my fair share of scouting reports, and that was important for me because to show that we are a holistic approach to the game, and that we are not trying to force data on anybody, and that we recognize it's only part of the puzzle. And I think that's the major story that we have to give. I would say that the Premier League, for obvious reasons, and MLS are right up there in terms of their use of data. But then you find some pockets of clubs in certain countries who are doing some incredible things, probably way out of their budget and way out of what you'd expect. If I was able to list them, I think people would be fascinated by how they're able to do something that some of the bigger clubs in Europe and in Champions League particularly aren't doing those things. And it's very much a choice at this stage.
Yeah, my next thing as a journalist would be to say, well, feel free to list those things. But what's happening obviously is proprietary knowledge, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And like with the integrity of the data for youth players, we take the integrity of our relationships with those clubs and federations very seriously. We've been very fortunate actually that someone like US Soccer was relatively open to talking about some of their processes. But at the end of the day, it's competitive advantage. We spend a lot of time working very closely with clubs in the same country. I can go from one training ground to another training ground in the same day and be working with them on very proprietary information. And we've had to build that trust over a long time. It takes a long time for clubs to trust that you're not taking something from one place and going to another place and sharing that with a team they're trying to compete for a title with. So it takes time.
In terms of other sports compared to soccer, where are we right now in soccer in the development and use of analytics?
So the biggest challenge we have, I think, is that soccer is very much a global game. And because of the scale of that and because of the fact that each league controls its own destiny to a large extent, FIFA and UEFA probably don't have the control over each league in the way that maybe NFL does or Major League Baseball does. And so that provides a challenge for them. And they're doing some really interesting work at the moment around trying to standardize the way data is collected. And there was some articles come out recently about that. And that's an interesting process, but it's a very difficult one because each league wants to control their own data collection. They want to know what data they're getting. There's the competitive advantage between leagues as well. So they're all fighting for broadcast rights and those types of things. So that's one of the biggest challenges in the, is that each league controls what data they can get and what they want to use. So that's probably slowed progress, particularly when it comes to new data sets like tracking data. You know, player tracking data is still relatively in its infancy in soccer. Most of the major leagues in Europe and you know, North America and South America have got a version of tracking data, but it varies country to country. It's an expensive bit of kit, and so installations and things like that are very expensive. So that's probably where we are behind the other sports. You know, we see on Sunday night football and Monday night football that, you know, even this season, I think they were tracking the kickers, kicking distance using the golf system TrackMan. So even things like that are making its way to broadcast. You know, Major League Baseball have done some great things with StatCast and showing fielding out probabilities and those types of things. We're not there yet. Now, what's interesting for me running the professional part of this business is that we're generally the first ones to get it. You know, something like expected goals that's really started to find its way into the media in the last couple of years. We started using that in the pro space in about 2011, 2012. Mm. So it takes 3 or 4 years before it starts to seep into the media and into the kind of public consciousness. Mm. Generally, in the professional space, we've been using it for a while. And that's, you know, that's the same with tracking data. We've had tracking data in the Premier League in various forms for probably about 10 years. Mm. But the ability to use that, it's a very different data set. It's a very complex data set. And also trying to understand what you can get out of it. You know, my guys at Opta, they get very bored of me saying this, but, you know, whatever data we have, it's got to have a tactical relevancy. You know, it's got to have an impact on performance. Otherwise, we're wasting our time. So the ability to understand player tracking data and be able to apply that to tactics and be able to then show that to a coach and get that conversation going about why this data impacts performance, that's the holy grail for every analyst. And so that's, you know, that's our next big challenge in soccer, is to really harness the power of tracking data, link that to the on-ball event data that we already have, and really start to use that to be a powerful tool for understanding performance.
We mentioned US soccer earlier. Is there anything MLS is doing that stands out to you right now?
What's always been fascinating about our relationship with MLS is their unbridled ambition around innovation. And I have to say, I do love spending time with the guys at MLS. I always come out kind of very invigorated and excited by what's next, because they do want to be at the forefront. And we've seen that even in their broadcasts, that they always try and push the envelope when it comes to that. So as a league, they're very focused on innovation. You know, even down to very small things, like their fantasy game is probably the best soccer fantasy game that exists. It uses way more data than anyone else's. It uses more interesting data than anyone else's. So very little things like that actually show where the league is trying to get to. So as a league, they're very focused on the innovation piece and will continue to do over the next few years. They've got some really exciting plans. And then from a club perspective, you know, kind of my bread and butter, they've always been at the forefront of this. And actually, one of the most interesting things about MLS is the analyst community that exists. Mm-hmm. They're very joined up. There is actually a working group in MLS that of the analysts from each of the clubs that mm-hmm. meet on a regular basis to discuss the future of data and how they can harness it the best. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't exist in other leagues. You know, people don't want to chat like that. You know, we've done a reasonably good job in the Premier League of getting guys together. We have a forum every year in February that kind of brings everyone together and actually brings them alongside the blogging community, a community that I didn't even realize existed until I joined Opta, but it's a huge, huge community. And they're doing some incredible things as well. You know, guys who are doing cancer research by day and soccer analytics by night, you know, is an incredible thing. And so again, it's just a way of harnessing that information and that talent to influence what we're doing in the game. But MLS is certainly, as a league and certainly by individual clubs, is well out there in terms of what they're doing.
In terms of your story, I'm curious to know, how did you get to the point where you're doing what you're doing now? What was your path?
I don't know whether, how interesting it is, but I guess it started, I played a lot of sports as a kid, and continue to do actually. I started, you know, playing cricket, huge cricket fan. But actually the sport that I probably played to the highest level was field hockey. So I represented Wales in field hockey. And when I was 17, 18, just before I was about to go to university, I got injured at a major tournament. We were out in Italy and, you know, had basically 10 days where I wasn't going to play. And so I kind of spent some time with the analyst and he was just pulling video together of our opposition and I didn't have a lot else I could do. So I sort of helped out and that, you know, got my interest in analysis and data and how that could help performance. I'm a huge Boston sports fan and I have been since I was a kid. On a Sunday afternoon was one of the best days of my childhood. We had the NBA highlights show, followed by some NFL football, and then Serie A football as well after that. So it was a perfect afternoon for me as a kid. So my interest in the way data was probably being used in the sports, I probably didn't understand it at the time, but I think that influenced what I wanted to do next. So I went on to university and studied sports science and analytics, and got an opportunity to go and work for Everton Football Club as an academy analyst. So spent 2.5 years there, a fantastic club that I couldn't have wished for a better grounding in the game. I think I may have mentioned on the panel at the weekend, the best piece of advice I ever got, and I honestly don't think I'd be here without this piece of advice. I walked into Everton Football Club a little bit in awe of the place, and you know, we had some pretty talented players at the time. And at the same time, I'd watched a lot of soccer as a kid. I knew the game. And someone sat me down. I must have come across a little bit arrogant at 18. And they sat me down and said, look, you are here to provide analysis. You're here to provide a different insight into the game. And that's where your skill set lies. But you don't know football. You don't know the game. So learn from all these people that do. You're going to be sat with coaches and managers and former players that have played this game all their lives and have played at the highest level. So just sit and listen. And that is the best piece of advice I've ever been given. And so I spent the next 10 years sat in meetings and rooms with coaches and managers and players, listening to them and learning the game. And that was, you know, amazing. And I think that's probably, again, one of the advice I give to a lot of people who want to get into this side of the industry, is that you may be the smartest analyst in the room. You might be the smartest person with data, but I can almost guarantee you won't be the smartest soccer person in the room. So make sure you learn that piece as well. So I then went and spent 10 years working for 5 Premier League clubs. Started as a sort of performance analyst, working on opposition analysis. Spent some time at Fulham doing that role during, you know, probably the most successful period of the club's history, which was amazing. And then went on into scouting roles at a couple of Premier League clubs to set up their European scouting department, but all powered by data. We didn't have scouts in every country. There was, you know, a couple of the clubs, there was 2 or 3 of us who could go and cover European football, which is tough. So we used data instead. We started with the data to whittle down our targets and then would go and watch those players. So I had an amazing grounding. I was, you know, a lot of it is about timing. So I was very fortunate to find my way into Everton. And then from there, worked with some of, you know, the most talented managers and coaches that I could possibly wish for. to really learn the game and really understand how it works, and whether that's on the pitch or actually off the pitch, and the process that goes on in terms of making decisions, and, you know, not always the way you'd want it to be made. But, you know, that was a fascinating insight, and I love my time in the game. And I certainly will never dismiss going back at some point. But again, in this role over the last 3 years, I've been very fortunate to travel all around the world, working with teams everywhere, and understanding their processes and understanding the cultural challenges, the market challenges that you know, teams and federations have, and just trying to support their processes and trying to help them apply the data and the technology in the best way.
Well, as we saw last week in Boston, this is not only a growing field, there are a lot of people aspiring to work in it. And so that's one reason I wanted to ask you about your path, and also appreciate the advice that you're able to share there, because there's clearly a lot of people who are wanting to go into the field. Ben McCreal, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you very much, Grant. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank JP Delacamera and Ben McCreal, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Just a quick reminder, it's a huge help if you subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast. It helps people find us. See you next time.